Okay. Basically, this is a study on, I wanted to look at the bilingual population here at the University of Michigan. And I started out thinking I would just look at whatever people I could find who are bilingual. And then I realized that it would be difficult to kind of find anything out about it if I was just looking at whatever languages I came up with. So I ended up concentrating on two different languages. And I also concentrated on the easiest samples I could find. So I have a Spanish, English bilingual sample taken from a class actually of self-identifying U.S. Latinos. So that's something to consider. And then I have a sample from a Hindi class, two Hindi classes actually here, which are mostly bilingual heritage speakers of Hindi or another Indian language. Basically, no one other language is highly represented besides Hindi, but I'll talk about that a little bit in a minute. The things I was really looking for were had to do with theoretical affiliation with a language community, which I had sort of assessed using these measures, basically. Theoretical affiliation, like, do you think that you will be basically affiliated with this language community in this way in the future? So first these are just theoretical, right, though. They have nothing to do with what we're doing now, and I'll talk a little bit about one other thing I asked that's about right now in a minute, but these are basically the main things I was looking at. And I also looked at the importance of maintaining or increasing the proficiency in language A, for these various reasons. And what I ended up doing in terms of figuring out what these meant and how they correlated was looking at basically what I did for these scores or these answers is I gave them 2 points if they said yes, 1 point if they said maybe, 0 points if they said no. So I have an aggregate score for that, and I have an average score for this one. Depending on the various things. And I'll show you a little bit about how those broke down. There's a lot of different things you can consider in terms of what will influence, you know, how someone perceives their own identity and how important it is for them to maintain their other language. Basically, with students at the U of M, we're looking at people who are basically socially mobile. So I sort of went in assuming that I would find people who would be more tending to be agents of language shift rather than language retention, in the sense that most of the students, like in the Spanish-English bilingual sample, 3 out of 11 had grown up in a Latino neighborhood I measured that just by saying, you know, did you have neighbors who spoke Spanish? Did you have classmates who spoke Spanish? And only 3 of them answered yes to either of those. So basically, most of them did not grow up in a bilingual community, except for that of their parents. And I've done qualitative interviews. I haven't finished evaluating all that yet. But basically, for the qualitative work, it seems like most of the students did indeed grow up in an integrated community. And they often say, well, I spoke Spanish or Hindi with my parents' friends or my parents' friends' children, but I didn't, you know, have friends at school who spoke it or whatever. Another thing to consider, of course, is the different language groups. Hindi, obviously, is not as widespread in the United States as Spanish is. So in terms of usefulness or accessibility in the United States, it's a little different. So I'm just going to look at some differences between the two groups for a moment here. This is the answer to the second question, which is about the importance of these various reasons for maintaining or increasing fluency in language A, right? And I've got this little graph at the bottom, which basically tells you that, I sort of labeled this, so basically for the Hindi class, 75% answered, had an average of this or higher, the 75th percentile, half of them had this or higher, 25%. So you can see that the Hindi class has a much lower range, basically, of answers, okay? And you can basically see that that's from these two numbers here, circle one here. So for professional and academic reasons, Hindis were rated not that much more, much lower than the Hindi speakers than the Spanish speakers. And that was pretty much across the board. And you can think of some obvious reasons for that. Another interesting thing, you can see there's some variability. I don't think that the rest of it's very significant, though, the variability in the different ranges. There is some variability, though. There is still, like, this is a relatively low compared to the other scores for Spanish speakers, to the academics, but it's still relatively high. This, a rating of 4 just means important. Anyway, so. And then, just to look at the other thing I was interested in measuring, this is the questions on theoretical affiliation. I broke these down to proportions, so this is like basically like 36%, 55%. So for this, for the Spanish English bilingual sample, or the Spanish class, I should just say, basically, there's a lot more higher ratings in the yes category. Like a lot more people who said yes to everything. And there's also very few people who said no to anything. You'll see here, most people said at least maybe, you know, or yes. And that, again, might have something to do with also the samples taken from a U.S. Latino, self-identifying U.S. Latino class. And so students who are in this class presumably are already relatively invested in being a U.S. Latino and self-identified. But at the same time, the Hindi speakers, no one said no, for example, no, they would not marry a Hindi speaker, but you know, two people, I believe that represents two people, said they would never marry someone who was a Spanish English bilingual, basically. Okay. And you see, again, there's a higher distribution for the Spanish speakers and the Hindi speakers for the aggregate score, like all of these together. See, the other interesting things, only one person, I think, said yes, they would live in a country where Hindi is spoken, basically India, right? Whereas several people said yes, they would live in a Spanish-speaking country, definitely. And let's see, the other interesting thing is that hardly anybody said that they would not raise their children bilingually in any of the samples. There was two people total in those samples that said that they would not raise their children bilingually, or maybe actually they didn't even say would not. They said maybe I won't. You know, and one of them like even wrote a comment in like, I'm not sure if I'm proficient enough to bring my children up bilingually. Like I want to, but so basically you can see by just looking at that that basically for all of the students sampled, they are all pretty invested in thinking that bilingualism is a good thing. You know, overall, something they want to pass on to their children. In the interviews, that comes out as well. Okay. So I was interested also in how these correlate. I was saying, thinking, you know, well, maybe some people are interested in being part of this community, the bilingual community, but they're not really interested in having high proficiency in language. So there is a high correlation between these two things. So this is the average. This is the average score of like the 5-point rating thing, and this is the aggregate score of like yes, maybe no. Do you want to do this? Do you want to do that? And there's like a high correlation. I think it's 0.72.
Sorry, could you just be clear on what's correlation with what?
Okay, this is the average interest. So this is like rate the following. How important is it for you to maintain or increase language A? I need to put this up. Rate that on a scale of one through five, basically, for the following reasons. That's this question. Right there. That's the bottom one. Every religious. And then I just averaged their scores. Okay? And that's this scale. This is the aggregate score, so they get 2 points for every yes and 1 point for every maybe. So somebody who has a 12 answered yes to everything. Okay? Somebody who has a 3 probably only answered yes to one thing, maybe to another, or something like that. So, and there's, you know, there's definitely variability. You know, there's people who it's really important to them to maintain language A, and yet they have a low theoretical affiliation. But there is correlation overall. And these are the questions. I was interested in marrying someone who speaks language, I think, for the Hindi speakers. And I actually ended up asking some people in the qualitative interview whether they were interested in arranged marriages. And I only had one person say they were considering it still. So. But since that's a big thing for recent immigrants, of course, especially. Now, another thing that I realized when I started looking at this is I asked the question, are you involved in any religious organizations, student organizations, classes, whatever, where people speak language A? And just correlating with the religion thing, I got actually really a pretty high correlation. So this is just like yes or no, if you participate in a religious organization, you really speak language A, okay? And you see, this is the average of the five, so this is the, you know, how important it is for you to maintain language. And you can see that these are both for the Spanish sample. So for the Spanish sample, I mean, these are pretty low numbers, so it's kind of weird to see it in this form. But this just basically means that wherever this black line is, 50%, whatever, answered higher than that. So you can see that everybody who's yes involved in their religious organization rated all fives for all the treatments. So, and here again, you see that like half of all this, like two of these students are all gave almost all yeses basically for all those added questions. It's kind of weird to see this in these low numbers. I tried to do this with that.
Have you got a misprint there? Is one of them helping?
No, these are all Spanish classes. These are for religion or yes or no. This is the aggregate score for like, do you imagine yourself marrying somebody who speaks language A, whatever. So this is just for the Spanish one. And you say a little different distribution with the Hindi class, but with similar overall results, except for the, this is reversed, so let me just do it one at a time. This is the aggregate score. So you see, again, there's a higher, like, median. This is, like, for yes, no, maybe. Do you want to marry somebody? Do you think you'll marry someone? That's definitely still higher for people who are involved in religious organization now, but it's a little more spread out. The Spanish sample seemed pretty more polarized. There's also fewer people in the Spanish sample who are involved in religion. Here, there's the opposite. There's 9 students involved in religion and 4 are not. So, but then this is kind of bizarre. I don't know what to make of this, but I'll just show it to you. This is for the average rating of reasons. And there's this huge spread of people who said yes. And then there's this really small spread of people who said no. And so that's maybe just says that maybe religion doesn't correlate with the importance of speaking Hindi as much for these students, okay? It's a small sample, so it's hard to make these kind of conclusions, but it does seem like pretty different than the Spanish sample, where there was a higher correlation in both cases with being involved in religion. Okay. So, basically, what I came up with, I guess, is that there is that language is really important to these students in terms of their affiliation with this community, bilingual community, or their cultural community, maybe in a larger sense to say that. Because the other thing about this is they are taking this class in language, which means that they're investing time and energy in learning this language, but it also means that they're not already super proficient in this language, right? So they're not like the ideal bilingual, and we all know that that doesn't happen very often, but they, you know, they're not like going from being already, you know, totally maybe a part of this community and then taking this class, of course, because they're wanting to improve it, especially for the Spanish speakers, I would say that, I guess, just because when you talk about Hindi speakers, I just imagine it being more, I mean, if you're not even learning those character set in school, you know. And a lot of, from the qualitative interviews, a lot of what I got was that people rejected their home language as a child. They'd often say, oh, I told my parents to stop speaking Spanish to me, you know, all this stuff when they were a kid. But now I want to, you know, so there's this kind of change in heart sort of coming with age. And the other thing is that it's interesting to see why it is that students want to revive their other language in a sense, okay? And basically what I've decided is that they are basically interested in it because of they want to use it as a way to be part of this cultural identity. And these are the same quotes that I had before, so people who've seen this already exploring for it. Basically, these are two interviews where basically the student said right out, the reason I want to speak Spanish is because I want to be considered Latino, and I feel like this is like validates in some way, basically, what they're saying. So she says, because I don't look like a Latino person, since I'm not brown, let's see. Are your kids going to be, you know, Hispanic? And so I want to know, you know, I want to speak Spanish, basically. This is kind of what it's coming down to. And this student has the same basic idea. She says, it's part of myself. I want to get back that back, you know. And then she says, basically, I look African American, and most of my friends have been African American, so I really haven't had that much. And, you know, so she's basically getting this idea that she wants to be part of a Latino community in some way that she hasn't been so far, and she feels like Spanish is going to come somehow help her her overall identity with that. So that's kind of what's coming out of the qualitative data. I haven't finished analyzing most of my qualitative data, so that's all that for now. How am I doing? How much more have I got? That's most of it. Okay.
Briefly, a couple of minutes perhaps.
Okay.
Questions. I think we have 20 minutes if you still have.
Yeah, I think, and then it's time for questions. And then there's this is my bag. One other interesting thing, and I already talked about this in my other presentation, but there was this distribution. Let me just find that. There was this distribution in terms of who, I asked people who they spoke Spanish or English with, or who they spoke, I guess, language A, who you speak language A with. And there was this thing that is typical of bilingual populations, of course, but it's interesting to see it, where you get the speaking both with their parents, 14 out of, this is for both language groups, 14 out of, 24 total speak both with their parents, okay? Six speak only language A with their parents. But with siblings, you see a much higher rate of speaking only English. Okay? So a lot of students told me in this interview too, they said, I only speak English with my brother. Some speak both, very few speak only language A. Only one person only speaks language A with his friends. And eight only speak English, which is less, in fact, than people who only speak English with their siblings. But the thing about the friends thing, I should just say that this whole friends line is kind of strange because this 15, this 15 is kind of like, we don't really know what that is. It could be like, I have one friend who speaks English and everyone else speaks language A, or it could be like, I have 15 friends who speak English and one friend who speaks language A. So that doesn't really tell us much. But there are eight people who only have friends basically speak English. So that's who are just not involved, basically, in a language aid community at this point, in terms of their own peers. My transparency. So basically, my conclusions were that students who are more involved in a bilingual community or who see themselves becoming more involved in it in the future with these kind of imaginary questions are also more concerned with maintaining language A, be that Hindi or Spanish or Gujarati. Or there's, I probably no one in here does Indian languages, but I can mention that the different languages, I was asked this before, so the different languages that they spoke besides Hindi were Marathi, Urdu, two Gujarati, and one Oriya. So there's kind of a wide range of other languages. And Arabic, one of them spoke Arabic. Okay, so basically there is this high correlation between seeing themselves being involved in this community and wanting to maintain language A. So that sort of says to me there's the language is an important part of their cultural identity. And often students, when I ask them that, I said, What does your culture mean to you outside of the language? You know, they would kind of say, well, there's food and, you know, there's, you know, the religious customs, they'd often say, but beyond that, that was kind of it. There's some other interesting things that came up. But language aid, the language seemed to play an important part in it. I'm sort of wondering, and I don't know if I'll be able to answer that in this, but I'm sort of wondering in what way the students hope to retain language A if they're not going to be involved in the community, and then you get into this more symbolic orientation towards this community, where it's like, I want to be whatever, an Indian American, but maybe I'm just tend to spend more time with, you know, English-speaking Americans or whatever. So that's an interesting question. I don't know if I can answer that, but it's just a thought for the future. Okay. So,
any questions?
Yeah. Okay.
Actually, I had a question. I have two little questions. Mm-hmm. One, I know we've talked about going through the process of making the questionnaire and how you go through drafts and pilot that sort of thing. And I was thinking maybe if, I don't know if you're going to do this again or you're going to rework the questionnaire at all, but I was noticing that there was a really low number for both groups with regard to their plans to use the language in academic context.
Mm-hmm.
And that really struck me. And I can only speak for the case of Spanish speakers, but I was wondering maybe if you would also in the future want to look at what their perceptions of Spanish were. I mean, there's a real perception that I catch from students that Spanish is not an academic language. It's not a language in which you function intellectually, which is, of course, untrue, but I wonder how many of them perceive it that way. They've been conditioned to perceive that.
I don't know how much... I think that's a really interesting point. I don't know how much this question is going to get to that, because a lot of that was like, will you use it for that? I mean, is that a reason for you to keep it up? Okay. Mm-hmm. And in that sense, I guess that's true, though, because if they say no, or they say it's not really important, then
for an academic,
then that means that they're probably not planning on, I don't know, studying in it or using it.
Just do an accuracy check on this. My memory is that Spanish... The responses are much higher in Spanish than Hindi.
They're higher than Hindi.
It's still lower relative to Hindi.
Yeah. I'll put up this one. This is actually, I thought this was harder to read, so I changed it to being a frequency table. But basically, you can see here there's. This is the one. This is the one. For the Spanish sample, it's still 4.1, which means it's important.
Yeah.
But that does mean, I mean, there was definitely several people in the Spanish sample which circled 5, 5, 5, 5, 5, you know. So, you know, it does mean that more people were circling 4 or whatever than not. Yeah?
Well, there might be something to that, because one of my best friends is actually taking this class.
Oh, okay.
Yes. And I spent a lot of time with her.
Uh-huh.
And all the stuff that we were talking about, you know, this whole pressure to want to become one that belongs to the community and to actually feel that at times because she's not as, she doesn't think she's as proficient, that she's not just having this symbolic baggage take from people throughout her life that she wants to become a Spanish speaker. But in terms of the academic stuff, it would seem to me that the class actually encourages the students to look at Spanish in a new domain,
right,
which is very academically based. Right. So it would be interesting to actually, perhaps, in another time, another place, in the world, to actually see, you know, these language attitudes before the class begins.
Right, that would be helpful. Yeah, Holly mentioned.
You know, see what happens in the mid, because I do know some people who are just totally amazed that they can actually feel like they can find academic Spanish and mm-hmm. that they feel validated in
okay.
that domain.
Okay, mm-hmm. So maybe there's some, maybe that has something to do with this difference too, because I don't think that that's an emphasis in the class. And when I asked students about that in the interviews, there were more people. People didn't mention that they wanted to use it for academics necessarily, but that's how people mentioned for the Spanish that they wanted to use that for work. When I asked about Hindi, I got kind of different answers. You know, some people would say, "Oh no, you don't even need Hindi in India. You can speak English." One person said, "Well, it'd be nice maybe if I can do business in India or something. Maybe I'll speak Hindi." That was like one. Interviewed. So maybe that has something to do with the class, I'm not sure. It would be nice to find that out more sample time. But it's basically, I think it's true though that Spanish is seen as more useful in this country though. At least professionally, I mean, I think that's definitely, even without the class.
There is no sign of a sharp split in those figures at the time in the literature. I made this comment before between domestic functions and professional functions.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, right, 4.5 and 4.1 are lower than 4.8,
yeah.
4.6, but not that much lower.
Yeah, but I think that also is very common by the fact that this is a self-selected group. I think if you do the whole
thing. I've been trying to find some unmotivated Spanish for this year. I have to kind of take one, but it's hard to find people who aren't organized.
And
then
you tell interested in Spanish people.
There are.
I referred her to one of my classes.
Yeah. I have people in my class who, my original sample is actually in my class, my kind of test sample from this year. I got some unmotivated people.
Are these all people who are planning on living and working in the United States for the rest of their existence?
All the people? Well, I asked them that, and what they said was, let's see, live and work, okay, so most of these people are U.S. born, maybe that's helpful to answer
okay.
first. Of all these students, I think 5 are not U.S. born, and most of those are naturalized. So I think there's only one actual, like, on a visa person in my entire group that I got from these two classes. So most of these students are U.S. born American students. And let's see, 3 say that they might, that they will definitely work. This is a Spanish sample. 7 say maybe. Only one says no. For the Hindi, working language A is like 3 and 7. More people say definitely no. And living in a different country, only one said yes. One said maybe.
Did anyone mention travel?
I didn't ask them about traveling. I did ask them in the interviews how often you go. The Hindi speakers that I spoke to in the interviews, I mean, it's hard to know with that because then I just picked whoever was willing to do an interview with me. But they said they seem to have gone more often, actually, than the Spanish speakers, which surprised me because I thought, well, Puerto Rico is a lot closer, Mexico is a lot closer, why not go there? You know, the Indian speakers seem to have a closer relationship. One of them goes like every 2 years, and another one's been several times. And
what about maintenance in order to keep relations with family members who live outside the U.S.?
Who live outside the U.S.? That was what a lot of people said in the interviews. They said either their grandparents or whatever, their relatives, they wanted to be able to speak with them. But I didn't really, I mean, I said, you know, do you speak language A with your other relatives? But I didn't really sample that.
I think we should
move
to this point and move on to the next one. Otherwise, we're out of time. It's interesting.
Okay.
Did you want to
get a question? Yeah, it's a real quick question. You know, there were people saying that very few people, obviously, saying that they weren't interested, pretty much weren't interested, and it's highly likely that they won't marry a speaker of this language. I was wondering when they were saying that they were talking about not wishing to marry somebody who was dominant in Spanish or Hindi, or whatever that language was, or somebody who was a bilingual. Because those are two very different things.
Briefly about that, because
somebody who grew up and was kind of.
That was something that Holly asked about before here. Did you ask about that? Maybe someone else did. But sometimes when I wrote these things, I said, I don't really know what people think this means, you know?
Yeah.
And that's kind of one of the weird things about doing a questionnaire like this, you know? But I sort of had the feeling, because I put no English, I thought maybe that would clarify, like, that means they do not speak language at all. Okay? So that means that it's somebody who's not bilingual. So I sort of hope that that would clear that up, but I also don't know what people think about what I mean by personal. I guess people can imagine. The other thing I put on here for the Spanish questionnaire is cultural, and what people mean by cultural. You know?
The first question is: this speaks language A only, or speaks also English, like being bilingual?
I didn't say that. I just imagined people would say, "Does this person speak it at all?" To whatever degree.
Could make a difference.
If you say they're bilingual.
You know, if they only speak that one language and you need to communicate with them in that language.
Right. So maybe to ask instead of that.
That's the second time as you say that's come up. So
right.
Maybe the next password,
maybe
make it
say
more
like,
explicit.
Yeah, make it like, do you imagine yourself marrying somebody who's bilingual or only language A or both or English or... I can make that two separate questions, I guess.
We really need to move on now.
Okay.
I need to go next. I'm sorry, Linda.
That's okay.
I know you're...
My presentation, I can give it in a faster or shorter way, depending on the time that is left. I mean it, because...
I guess we have to make it 20 minutes.
Doesn't matter.
Is that okay?
Yeah, I can make it 20, I can make it 30, I can make it 15.
Okay.
Because it's just the article.
I have no data.
What?
I have no data.
Oh. I do have data.
Oh, yes. Well, do you want to resolve this by going first? Would that help or what? What's the best way to do this?
You can keep the time that you need, and then I fill the rest, because I can change the time.
Yeah, that's fine. It's just that... I'm not gonna fill the whole time, so that's
fine. Oh, that's fine.
It's fine. That's exactly good.
So do you want an
interactive.
But you know me, I'm sure. And we managed to ruin your just on hold you right, but it's pretty stuffy. Oh, it just gets too noisy.
It's okay. Can you open it a little?
Just a couple of inches to let us squeeze the oxygen.
I'm not going to use the projector.
Okay.
I'm sorry, it's still rolling. Okay.
Thanks.
It's so funny, I have no problems in front of my students.
Well, this matters less is at stake.
I'm sorry?
Less is at stake than teaching a class.
Oh, yes. Especially when I have to take an exam. Okay, I think I need to sign this really quickly, right?
Biggest
borderlines in the American languages with Spanish language.
Areas where they're in contact with.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And that would include, I'm really concentrating on bilinguals and other language contact phenomena. Let me just give you a little bit as to why I'm interested in this. First thing, let's see, I did a lot of coursework at UCLA on American Indian Studies. So that is kind of one of my specialties, North American Indian Studies. And I also, my dissertation interest is in Indian Studies. And one of the things I wanted to find out was, what happens in borderland situations in terms of language and culture. And I felt that I really had not done a lot of research in this particular area. I was thinking about doing my presentation on Andean bilingualism, but I said I have a lot of time to do it. So what I'm concentrating on is on the Pueblo culture to the Southwest. And I'm including the Navajos separately because actually they're not from the Southwest. They actually came from the North. And they've been around for like thousands of years, some people say. It's extremely controversial in terms of that, but they know themselves and others know them as not being from there. In terms of the Pueblos, they've been there in terms of the archaeological record since I would say 1500 years. And they've been in terms of the contemporary geographic locations of these people, you would have to look at Arizona, New Mexico, Utah. I would say, what else is the Southwest?
Colorado.
I'm sorry?
Colorado,
yes. But mainly Arizona and New Mexico. And these people have been in contact, actually, with the Spaniards since the 16th century. And that happened because of Hernando de Soto's conquest of Florida, going, you know, under the supervision and tutelage of the Spanish. After that, you have, when Mexico was already established as a colony of Spain, you have a lot of conquistadores going up north. So that's when you actually have the first contacts of Spanish speakers with Native American speakers. Let's see. And you have a situation where these conquistadores actually get a lot of slaves from these communities, and they actually teach these people Spanish so they can serve as interpreters. So you have a whole line of families involved in this. And from this, you have the spread of translators, and also you have the spread of missionaries, because along with the conquistadores came the missionaries. So the medium, as is in the case of the Americas, the medium for proselytization is Spanish, in terms of the Jesuits and other Spanish missionary people. You have the English speakers coming in this century, which is really interesting. You have them coming in for mainly commerce with the Pueblos and also for expropriation of their lands. Mm-hmm. So you have a whole historical struggle of Pueblo peoples and Navajos being transplanted from different parts of the Southwest, kind of being transplanted from one neighborhood to the other. And this happens, and by neighborhood I don't mean like, you know, small localities, but actually wide regions. This happens actually throughout the century. Even now in the 70s, you still have conflicts over land between the Spanish speakers, the mainstream political authorities, Congress, and Pueblos and Navajos. Mm-hmm.
You also have a situation where, because of all this linguistic and cultural contact, you have a lot of loss in terms of both peoples and languages. And the three major languages of this area are Navajo, Pima, Papago, and Apache, which I was surprised because I didn't think that Apache was actually that of a dominant language, because I thought from research that I know that Apache speakers were actually decimated in the late 1800s. Mm-hmm. Where you still have monolinguals and bilinguals especially. For instance, you have the USA Bureau of Indian Affairs citing an approximate number of speakers for each of these languages. You have about 130,000 Navajo speakers. You have 1,500 Pima Papago speakers, and you have 9,000 Apache speakers. They really don't delineate exactly who the speakers are, you know, in terms of the bilingual continuum. But I guess you can imagine that a lot of them are bilinguals. Within the Navajo Nation, which is an amazing nation, I think, it actually covers four states. That's why it's called the Four Corners, right? And that has as a result of all this transplantation, as a result of them moving. As soon as you have Anglo speakers and also other Native American communities, you have Navajos being transplanted both forcibly and also in terms of, you know, in terms of their own desire, volunteering that those dislocations. And when it comes to dealing with Native American languages and Native American speakers in the Southwest, one also has to deal with Chicanos, because both of them, Native Americans and Chicanos, are actually what you consider territorial minorities. They're actually people who, if you have to say who were there first, and within those two communities, there's a lot of controversy as to who was there first. We don't want to get into that. We just need to know that. Let's see. You have another situation going on, which is interesting. You have the situation of the Southwest and Mexico. Several researchers, including Jane Hill, have conducted studies on loan words, and they found that you have a considerable degree of borrowing in some Native American languages. They found Nahuatl borrowing, which come from as early as, you know, I would say before the conquest. And you still have those remnants, which is really interesting. What's interesting about the Southwest too, in terms of the populations there, is that you don't only have bilingualism, but you also have trilingualism, which becomes much more complex in terms of studying those linguistic repertoires. You have situations where usually in terms, there's certain typologies of language contact in Native North America, but in focusing in the Southwest, you have speakers who are beyond 30 usually are bilingual, bilingual, trilingual, in their Native American language, Spanish and English, and you have speakers who are younger, of course, usually are much more English dominant. And in this situation, you have a situation of this phenomenon called Indian English, mm-hmm. which is been categorized very similarly to Black English or Puerto Rican English, where you have certain phonological, international semantic similarities from the native language. You have this scholar by the name of William Leap, who's actually devoted his life to this type of study, and he usually has looked at Navajos
Navajo. Is it specifically Navajo English he's interested in, or is it the whole repertoire?
The whole repertoire. What's interesting about it, he that's a really good point. He does state that as there are different types of Englishes, you also have different types of Indian English. So you have Navajo Indian English, you have Hopi Indian English, you have Cherokee Indian English. So one has to also get to know the native language in order to figure out what are the similarities and where do they diverge. So I would say the same thing with Spanish. You have Puerto Rican English and you probably have Colombian English. Although, depending on the kind of situation, you could have dialect leveling in that sense too. The history about this Indian English is interesting because by the turn of the century, and this was like a widespread policy for Native Americans, by the turn of the century, you had Indian children being forced out of their homes into boarding schools. So you actually have kids coming from different reservations, different places around Native America, who actually had to deal with each other and understand each other. So English became like a lingua franca. So within that, you have that situation going on. You also have, in the 1950s, a termination policy which actually expelled a lot of the Native peoples into the cities, and that was another governmental policy where you have people also coming from different linguistic backgrounds, different languages, coming together and using English as a lingua franca. But then you have a situation where people become dominant and people are actually just using this Indian English. So there's been some research on that, but still it's ongoing because mm-hmm. you still have so many different languages. The typology is still not there, but it's a field that is very, very popular right now. And what's interesting about it, the situation is that it is identified in the literature. If one has Indian English, one can suppose that you also have Indian Spanish, mm-hmm. but that really has not been seen in the literature. And I think it has to do. You have a question? Yes.
Do you get cases where there are Native Americans who speak Spanish but not English?
Yes, you do. You actually have the older people in certain parts of the Southwest. There are some older generation of Navajos that are actually bilingual only in Navajo and Spanish. Depending on the closeness of the interactions with other Spanish speakers, especially Mexican speakers, you have the much more Spanish dominant. Mm-hmm. But within that, you can still talk about Indian Spanish. Just the same way you can talk about, the Spanish, the Andean Spanish that's influenced by Quechua or other languages, Native American languages. So that's interesting. I guess it's because we are in an English dominant society, academic world, so I'm sure people are studying that too. Let's see what else I can tell you guys. There's been one interesting study, and we probably will be very appreciative of it. It has to do with Susan Phillips' study in 1972 of this Warm Springs Indian classroom, where she actually studies the interactional dynamics of Indian children and how they use silence, how they use the notion of group solidarity to actually both create that solidarity and also separate themselves from others. So you have that, and I believe that she used a little bit of the C8 approach, but not the way that we've been doing it, much more on a sufficient type of way. And I think this is kind of like a very good field to get into because one of the biggest urgencies in terms of this research is educational stuff. You have, in terms of Indian English, you have the same old thing about the literature by semi-lingual speakers. The same thing is attributed to Indian English speakers.
And you also have the whole situation, not just linguistic, and this is interesting too, is like not just the person, especially the academic child, is not just a linguistic person in terms of a speaking actor, but also you have the situation of gestures, how gestures are read. I've read by the people in authority and how gestures can vary cross-culturally.
Well, this is real ethnography of speaking
yes.
stuff that we've
totally.
Probably looked at, I think, in this class.
Exactly.
It's
and that is something, you
it's
know.
It's Adele Hines' line.
Mm-hmm. And with a little bit of CA stuff there. So, and that's actually the only research that actually has been done. I'm sure people have done more of this type of research in terms of educational anthropology, perhaps. But in terms of actually being a research that goes beyond the educational classroom, that actually piques the interest of other scholars, this is a classic one. If that's an answer to. You have. Let me read you some language attitudes from different people. Among the Pueblos. Let's see if I have it here.
Can we wind up very soon?
Okay, this will be my last thing.
Read a slight scroll on this story.
This is something that is very, very interesting. And I hope I can find it. If you guys have any questions, feel free to ask. So look around.
Actually, I don't know if you built this, but I wondered if there was any evidence, like you've talked to me and Holly also as well
yeah.
about like in spaces like in New York City where Spanish, because there are so many different kinds of. So many different immigrant groups coming in, or you know, second, third generation, and they're all coming in with different kinds of Spanish.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's almost like a leveling, and there becomes one Spanish that's used across. You know, and
right.
is that happening in Native American languages?
In some places, it is. I would say in some urban sectors, it's happening because some urban community places have a longer history than others.
Mm-hmm.
Besides English,
it's
no.
And
Spanish in some places, but usually Spanish comes secondary to English.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. English is totally taking over the linguistic repertoire of a lot of communities.
Okay, but then there's no, like you were saying, as far as about how about Apache or something like that, saying like Apache and everybody speaks like a form of Apache and it kind of like you might add it to your repertoire, even though that might not be your first, you know, language.
Right.
Music.
Well, I don't know. I mean, that's question.
Yeah, you want
right.
There's so little research.
Yes, it's so little research actually, and I think it's just because of the complexity of the linguistic and cultural situation. One really, okay, this is one thing I would like to end with, which I thought was really interesting. There's this article by Michael Seversing, and let me tell you a little bit of this article. Okay, this article is in Journal of Linguistic Anthropology, and he has an article on Encountering Language and Language of Encounter in North American Ethnohistory. And one of the things it does says is that if you're going to look at a language contact phenomena in Native North America or in the Americas, dealing with Indian languages, one really has to look at the histories because there's so much history of transplantation, of removal. So the people who you at this point think are the native speakers of that region might not be at all. And this could just be 50 years, you know, down the line. It doesn't have to be like hundreds of years down the line. And that's one of the things that I think when, you know, that's one thing at times that we might forget to do, to actually do our research. And not that our research will necessarily
give us a one-to-one correspondence in terms of how language is being either borrowed or not borrowed or co-switch, but it will definitely make the complexity much more realistic.
Thank you. That's very interesting.
Thank you.
Okay. Thanks very much. I'm sure if it runs that way. Okay, so just take your time.
What I'm doing today, presenting today, nothing more and less than the article that we have from this book that we talked about in class, we started to talk about in class, and I promised to finish. And the title is Code Switching and Bilingual First Language Acquisition. And I'm going to be following your handout, so if you get lost or something, just stop me.
And you'd like people to ask questions as you go through it?
Please do.
Okay. Mm-hmm. This is an important article, so take advantage of her superior knowledge. She's also in a syntax class.
Well, I try to concentrate maybe more in the parts that we've been doing in class and less in the syntax. Mm-hmm. But let's see if we can make it together. Okay. First thing to start with is talking about the terminology, because when we talk about bilingual first language acquisition, Koepe and Meisel, these authors that are, by the way, German, working in the University of Hamburg, they refer to children exposed to and acquiring two or more languages simultaneously before age 3. And this is very important because we've seen the differences before. Just simultaneously, both languages at the same time, before the age 3. That means children could have lived in one or the other country, but until the age three comes. What they talk about is bilingual code switching, which is governed by grammatical and pragmatic constraints, which means that code switchers are required to have grammatical competence in both languages. But what happens with infants is that sometimes bilingual children use both languages in the same utterance or conversation, and they violate syntactic or grammatic constraints of code switching. This is what they call code mixing. And it can be accounted for by the failure in separating the two linguistic systems. That's what is called fusion. Due either to the lack of knowledge of syntactic and pragmatic constraints, or also could be to the lack of the necessary elements to which the constraints apply, or maybe both. There's one thing that they're going to have a look into. Important point is to determine from what age children organize language by grammatical means. And also the distinction between different categories of words and having these two elements counting for their study helps them to distinguish code mixing from code switching in early child language. So it depends really on from what age onwards children organize language, whether they're really using their syntactic knowledge or not. So that's really important for this distinction between code switching and code mixing. And what Koepe and Meisel do is comprehensive literature review about code switching acquisition. And they say that these studies are mainly referred to longitudinal studies on bilingual language acquisition, which typically concern a linguistic environment where each person speaks one language. So we know the situations of one parent, one language, or children speaking one language in the home and then one language outside of the home. They say the most studies, they refer to this, which is true, I think that in class. They divide their studies in two main tracks, like we've seen before. One is the pragmatic functions of code switching, and the other one is the syntactic aspects of language mixing. And starting with the pragmatic functions, we've seen two types in class. Do you remember which one they were? Can you just more or less a rough idea? Which two aspects, big aspect, talking about the pragmatic functions of code switching that we've seen in class?
change the situation, to indicate change of situation or context,
mm-hmm.
like
so
formal and informal.
Exactly. One was situational switching,
mm-hmm.
and remember the other one? One was the situation and the other was one was the
topic.
The topic situation and the other one was the speaker. Mm-hmm. Gumpers and
everything.
Okay, well, really this about situational switching, language choice is the ability to select the appropriate language as base language for the conversation according to the interlocutor, which is or the topic of the conversation or the situational context. And from around age of 2, the child switches adequately languages according to the interlocutor. Most children raised bilingual in a monolingual environment could experience a lock. That's why it calls their attention of Kirby and Maisel. That means this language shock, that means that the fact that most people talk in these children, most people who talk to them only understand one of the languages, these children start to develop a certain awareness, like I'm talking to this person and this person doesn't understand me. So that means they talk something else, but I understand them, maybe I talk two things. I mean, this is like the way children could think. And this, to that they become more aware that there's a language separation, there's two languages going on. This factor interlocutor becomes complex, especially with bilingual interlocutors, because children need to decide which language they're going to speak with this person and which language do they prefer, or they, if they prefer to use both codes at the same time. The other function of code switching we talked about is apart from situational switching, we have also conversational switching, which is the other main type of switching. And in case of bilingual hearers only, a code switching may be used to convey specific social or pragmatic information, such as metalinguistic awareness, metalinguistic comments, reflect their awareness. This is called, like I said, conversational switching, in contrast to language choice as situational switching. Do you remember all those cases in which, in the middle of a conversation, people would switch from one language to the other? We've seen it a lot.
Yeah, we also had it modeled according to Auer's definition,
mm-hmm.
if you recall, between participant-oriented switching
mm-hmm.
and discourse-oriented.
Right.
You know, these,
mm-hmm.
and that's the most recent version of that binary category you're talking about.
Mm-hmm. Which is basically the same with a different terminology. Yeah, this binary. But what has been reported is that from age 2 onwards, children begin to repeat their own utterances in both languages in order to call, for instance, the parents' attention or to ensure that they're being understood. From the age 3 onwards, they start to comment on their own language and to ask for translations, and this is really a sign of separation of languages. And from age 4 onwards, some children are reported to use marked language choice as a means of amusing the hearer or exclude a third person from the conversation.
Mm-hmm.
We've seen this as well before.
Mm-hmm.
And we'll see some examples for that. With respect to the syntactic aspects of language mixing, Kirby and Maisel, they gathered the literature about the studies that they're concerned with language mixing and language separation. The problem is most of the studies find out that the mixings are very low. We've seen this in class as well. This is mainly repetition of many things that we've seen so far. It's a bit of summarizing. What is necessary is to relate mixing rates to qualitative aspects of language. For instance, which categories are mixed, the structural condition for switching, how developed is the child's grammatical competence, etc. And also to pragmatic functional considerations. Are these mixes conscious? Do they respect social rules of language use? Is the addressee bilingual? The distinction between different categories of word mix helps to distinguish code mixing from code switching in early child language. So we need to distinguish which categories have been mixed to start with. And empirical studies have shown that in early stages, children mix function words. What are function words? Do you all know? Can someone explain that?
Compound
words.
Mm-hmm.
Well, yeah. All categories except nouns, adjectives, and verbs, which means they're more like function words, like the word says, the words that have a function, they're not really a content.
So content
mm-hmm.
versus function.
Content makes us functional lexical words, makes us functional words. In the fourth page, you have here the distinction. In the last column of the mixing tables, there's single words, mixed German and French, and they distinguish between function words and lexical words, and the percentages that we're going to talk about later. Okay. Was an author called Wiedemann who talked about these function words being mixed in early stages of children bilingualism. The problem is this is very problematic for the terminology and also because there are many contradictory studies about this. So people keep finding contradictions and Pepe Meiser said this is what has been found so far, but they found pretty much the same tendency, but some studies, like for instance Lanza's study, Elizabeth Lanza, who was published the last review in 97, she found contradictory findings about this. It's not exactly that children start with function words, but that's a tendency so far. It's been observed. Later on, nouns are predominant. It's been found that 75% of the switch words are nouns in both adults and children. And this coincides as well with borrowings. Most mm-hmm. borrowings are also nouns.
Mm-hmm. Did we ever discuss why nouns seem so? You know, people have ideas about why nouns are so liable to be shifted about. Okay, Holly, you're nodding. Do you know why?
One of the things I read was that there were more nouns.
Even
the corpus, for example, I think Poplar.
Yeah.
Now
even allowing for that, though, I think there's more nouns are transferred than in the language as a whole.
Yeah,
there are syntactic well, I mean, basically the argument is they don't drag a lot of syntax around with them. Mm-hmm. You know, if you have a verb, for example, some verbs are transitive, some intransitive.
Mm-hmm.
If you take a verb like eat, need not take an object, but if you take a verb like devour, you can't say John devoured. You've got to say John devoured something.
Mm-hmm.
And so if you transfer that item to another language, you have to know this. You have to have this abstract knowledge about how to use it. And that's its, well, I call it subcategorization. You might have another way of putting it.
Subcategorization,
okay.
Exactly.
But you see, nouns don't do this. Nouns are relatively easy to move about. They just don't drag this syntactic complexity. It's to do with the verb being the head of the sentence, effectively, really, isn't it? Just having this central role in the organization of the clause.
And now we cross languages.
Apparently, yes. Twyla Tardif was giving a paper in Chinese and suggesting it didn't happen with Chinese. But I'd have liked to look at her methodology because Chinese has strange rules for anaphora.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you can actually cut all kinds of things out of Chinese utterances and connected speech, but it's a pretty solid finding. It's coming up again and again.
Maybe something about Chinese also.
Yeah. Well, it's just that we know very well that people don't like violating syntactic rules of languages when they mix, and it's quite easy not to do this with nouns, but if you move verbs about and some other things like prepositions, it's much harder.
Mm-hmm. That's true. I'm going to retake that idea in a minute. Generative grammar tried to explain formal regularities in code switching by means of universal principles. That's really Chomskyan studies, try to find universal principles under linguistics, under every language. Although there are contradictory findings, it is agreed that mixing seems not to occur between constituents that are contained in the info phrase. I don't know if you know what the info phrase is. Inflection is, for instance, in a verb,
we have inflections.
The ending of the verbs. In Spanish, for instance, the verb hablo, I speak, we have this O tells us that it's first person singular, and tells us as well that it's the present tense. That's the inflection in the verb. So we wouldn't find things of the type, I don't, we wouldn't find these kind of reasons because the info phrase, and also like things like no quiero, to talk, we wouldn't find this at all as well. Because it's between, for instance, a finite, a non-finite verb, you wouldn't find this mixture. Right. You wouldn't find it between a subject clitic and a finite verb. I wouldn't find it, I hablo. And also between when a negation and a finite verb, you wouldn't either find this switch.
I've seen that third one.
I've
seen it and heard it many times and done it myself.
This is the whole
same
problem with
this.
Exactly.
I'm just
waiting for us to have that.
The first kind of like
mock Spanish to me.
I don't know.
Yeah.
Something like that.
Sorry.
It's true.
Yeah.
Well, what they found is in the data that this shouldn't appear. This was judged as speakers as non-grammatical.
Judgments on one thing, what they actually do or another is
exactly. I recently gave a presentation, like I said, about this topic, and it was also auto-code switching.
Mm-hmm.
And all the authors, they were based on data and judgment, and they got always contradictory findings from one or the other. And they weren't sure. They just guessed this should be this way, and there are too many contradictions.
I think there's no problem. You see, we did discuss this whole issue of whether these constraints were variable or categorical.
Yeah.
If you accept there's a tendency to avoid that, I think you're not in trouble.
Mm-hmm.
But if you try to say it's categorical,
yes,
very probably a harm.
I think it's true when you mentioned that in that meeting with the woman who does the language context.
Oh, Sally Thompson.
Yes. It was very good that you said that because I think she also accepted it. I mean, most people would accept that because that would be common sense to actually say that, instead of saying it's categorical, because then you have to...
Well, as you know, theoretical linguistics tends to work categorically. It doesn't like operating
It doesn't like the social linguistic tendencies.
Well, what we said about the info phrase of inflection is what they call functional head, and especially this functional category inflection is what it seems to constrain code switching.
Right.
And like we said, noun phrases, nouns, they don't present any constraints. They're freely moved. Research concerned with acquisition of code switching and syntactic constraint has to consider for children the general development of syntax in both languages. That's really important. The study that Kupi and Meisel carried out is called the Dufte study. I guess it's Dufte because it's German. It's a longitudinal study of simultaneous acquisition of German and French by 13 preschool children. They videotaped the children every 2 weeks for 30 minutes in each language, and then they transcribed both linguistic and non-linguistic interactions with their context. And I think that's really interesting because most people do just audio taping, and they just get the speech, but they also did their interactions, the non-linguistic interactions, in the context too. Really to catch the situation, especially for conversational switching. The results presented concern pragmatic and syntactic aspects of the mixed speech of two children, Annika and Ivar, both firstborn growing up in middle-class families in Hamburg. Both mothers are French and both fathers German, and each parent uses her or his respective language to talk to the child. Annika's parents talk to each other in German, while Ivar's parents talk in French. French is initially the dominant input language for both children because of their mothers, but after age two,
two six means 2 years and 6 months. Annika's German was stronger, whereas for Ivar, both languages were always in balance. And that was due to, can you imagine what was due to, what was depending on that one had German very strong and the other one both in balance?
In the home. Which one was spoken in the home? I can't remember now.
Mm-hmm. Annika's was speaking German in the home.
German in the home.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so because of the social interactions, traveling to France and coming back and visiting friends, one developed a stronger German and the other one was more balanced. And during the recordings, the interviewers were supposed to keep the languages separated. There's all this issue with, yes?
Do they mention anything about the development of their accent at all? I guess they're young enough, so it wouldn't make any difference. I'm right.
No, they didn't say.
Actually, there was a question on the list, on this dreadful bilingual list on email that we're all getting, 70 messages a day. Somebody was pointing out there was a paucity of studies of phonology of bilingual children. I think hardly anything is known about it.
Mm-hmm. That's true. I feel
that. I can't think of a single one, actually.
What is amazing is children have such capacity of reproducing sounds even though they don't know what they're saying.
One thing I'm going to say is all the students that I talked to in interviews, I asked them, like, they've often said, like, the Hindi speakers, they said, like, my Hindi is horrible, but I can say all the words exactly right. They have a good accent. And the same thing with the Spanish speakers, they said, well, I have a really good accent, because they would all take Spanish in high school, and they'd all talk about how they weren't that good, but they could get by because of the accent. It seemed like even though they're Spanish, their language wasn't that good, the phonology was there.
I was going to say that I asked, when I was taking phonetics, I asked Pam Bedore about if she knew of any research in bilingualism and phonology, and she said that
no,
it was really.
It was very important.
Yes.
But that's a good point you raised because it's very salient to speakers. I did a very similar experience. I used to speak German reasonably fluently, but it went away because of lack of practice over about 20 years. Then I went to Austria, and I was in the Tyrol, where they speak a very, very stigmatized dialect, very non-standard. And I staggered a few sentences together in German, and the chambermaid said, klassisches Deutsch, wonderful German. And that was my accent. I'd been taught to speak standard German. And they were ashamed of their accent. And she was prepared to ignore the awful things I was doing to the syntax. Just like, you know, it's similar, I think, to you and your speakers. But it's a very, very interesting area. I don't think everyone's on it. So, more research ideas.
Actually, I had a question. You're saying your Annika's German is stronger, and then for Yvonne, there was more of a balance, and I don't know, maybe you're going to get to it later, but I'm always curious how they measure. Like, how are you measuring what's balanced?
That's really the last table in the last
okay,
page,
cool.
Because they mentioned their utterances.
Uh-huh.
They don't really explain it that much, how they measure them, but because it's just an article, I think you need a better
thorough.
Yeah. But I think they measure in the total of utterances when they record it, one or the other, they measure, and also error, I suppose.
Yeah, predominance. They do explain, I think, what they mean. It's okay to use terms like balanced if you say what you mean by it.
Yeah.
And I think they do say, basically, that they use the languages more equally, just in terms of quantity.
Okay,
I think it's
so
that more than error,
that.
In fact.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Okay. We continue. It is important to separate both languages for one reason, because the communication will be determined by the adult monolingual. That means that code switching is expected to occur less often in a situation when it's pure monolingual than in a bilingual situation. But it's interesting because the use of two codes will be motivated by situational factors like language choice according to the interlocutor. So if you have a monolingual, pure monolingual context, and mixes occur as well, it would be interesting to see why do these mixes occur there. And as of opposed to if you have a bilingual situation when you have speakers of both languages, it would be more logical that children mix because they're talking, they're co-switching, they're talking to both speakers. But if it's just in a pure monolingual and they mix, this is really a chance to observe the motivations and the external factors that children may have to mix these languages in this situation that should be monolingual. The empirical results of the study, they said that at an early, starting with the pragmatic functions, at an early stage of development, if the child's utterances do not correspond to the regularities in use in its linguistic requirements, we may conclude that the child has not acquired those rules. But this may not be true, because it could also be that the child has developed his own rules and of language choice, and then they don't coincide with the ones of his environment. So this is the two possibilities they're playing with. In the data, both children, they select the appropriate language with each interlocutor from age 1-4 for Annika and 1-5 for Ivar onwards. The first switching appeared when the children were addressed by another person and answered to the respective language. We have here on the third page, you have in the handout, you have an example. I'm going to try with my French. Et quand est-ce qu'il va partir à Paris? Says the French interviewer. Avec le, and then Ivar directs himself to the German interviewer and said, Wie weit gehen? It means he's switching languages according to the interlocutor. Switches occur from, like we can see here, from 2-11, but it starts to occur from 2-5 onwards, and even 2 years old, sharp for Annika.
Mm-hmm. It's amazing, actually.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of people claim that bilingual children have much better developed metalinguistic awareness than monolinguals. That's
mm-hmm.
kind of reasonable.
Also, self-initiated switches are really interesting. It's when the child addresses someone without being asked. It started to appear from age 2.28 for Ivar and 2 for Annika. Annika seems to be pretty advanced for some things, but we'll see later that there's some contradictions in her as well. There's an example here, example number 2, when Ivar interacts with both interviewers, switching between languages and translating with, and also few errors occur. The German interviewer says, Frag sie doch mal, was isst du denn gern? What? Du pain? Quoi? Nee, no, du pain, comme manger. He corrects himself. He says, no, bread, no. What I mean is, like, what do you eat to eat? So he corrects himself. So he's aware of the switch in languages of the person he's talking to. And there are self-initiated switches. He came from himself. There's an example number 3 with Annika, when she corrects her errors and adopts different strategies to avoid errors, or when she uses the incorrect language. The German interviewer says, Annika hat uns gerade erzählt, dass sie selber der Osterhase ist. And the mother says, c'est quoi? And Annika says to Pasky, and then she hesitates and turns to the German interviewer and says, wir machen die Eier. So she realized and corrected herself. From age 4 onwards, Ivar uses marked language choice. This is something more elaborated in order to exclude a person from the conversation. And this situation is, she was talking to his mother in German and switches back to French to let the French assistant know he doesn't care that she understands what he's saying in German. Which is really curious because we know that Ivar talks in French to his mother. So he really wants to exclude this person and is using German consciously. Böse kleine Mädchen und dann haben sie aber bestimmt Angst. Moi, je comprends pas. Oui, mais ça c'est l'allemand, dis donc. Et comprends pas, Marie-Claude, tu sais. Oh, c'est pas rien. He's really rude, saying that I don't care, really. So he's being rude on purpose, but he's also, or he he's already 4 years, four months, so he's older now. He went over those 3 years of first hesitations, as some authors call them, and now he knows exactly what he's saying and his choice is exact for the situation. Talking about the syntactic constraints and code switching, it was observed a high mixing rate from the beginning of the record onwards, which at the ages of 2.5 and 2.0 for Annika decreased. With respect to the frequency of specific syntactic categories, like we said, nouns and noun phrases are mixed throughout the whole period of investigation, but function words decreased constantly from age 2.5 and 2, respectively, which this coincided with previous studies. And concerning the sentential position of switches, up to 2.4, most mixes concern sentences with omitted elements and can occur between all kinds of constituents. As we see in example 5, das Bateau, we have it between the determiner and the noun. Nonu, sand, we have two nouns, and tombe, verb, we have a verb and a noun. This preference cannot be accounted for in terms of syntactic constraints, because, well, they assume that they don't have syntactic constraints at this age yet, because the category info hasn't appeared yet. From age 2.5 onwards, violations of Poplack's free morpheme constraint were not observed in Ivar's speech. I don't know if you remember Poplack's free morpheme constraint. I can remind you if you want to. It says that non-switching can occur between a bound morpheme and a lexical form, unless that phonological form is phonologically integrated into the language, to the bound morpheme. For instance, you remember we had an example that was cacheando. From like catching, and the ando is the continuous gerund form in Spanish. Mm-hmm. You had like flipeando, like flipping, flipeando. That's okay because it's integrated, but you can have cacheando. Although we've heard them before, right? Yeah, that was my argument too. My other presentation, I said, this is what Poplack says, this is what I haven't heard. This is what I heard from speakers. So it's, again, one thing is reality and the other thing is what, depending on the data you get. Example 6 reflects these violations of constraints in Annika, actually. Because she has a few contradictions with respect to Ivar. And it says, this is in Ivar's, but it's earlier, and later on he doesn't. From 2.5, he doesn't do it anymore. This is when he used to do it. Nonon, s'il a arrêté, un délit ressourcé. So it's a mixture between French and German. Like, arrêté is from reiten in German, but with the ending of French.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And ressourcé is German for seek, for look for, and this re is the French. After the age of 2.5, again with Ivar, Ivar's intersyntactic missing was reduced to insertion of single nouns or switching between determinants and nouns in the object noun phrase. We have that. We can see that in example 7. Moi je vais à la cuisine. So it's just the word cuisine, kitchen, inserted there. Like I said before, Annika's data is contradicting Ivar's data. She uses the switch within sentences with omitted elements at a later age. When she was already 4 years old, like we can see in example 8, she's saying, Ila geboren. And also, Sase Daniels, we talked about this in class, she's given what do we call the genitive in German, she's attaching that to a French sentence. And I've observed that in Spanish speakers, Spanish, English, bilinguals, they do that. I observed that at age of two. And at the age of 3-7, it's supposed to be eradicated, but Annika said it. So could be a myself attributed that probably to performance errors, because this type of data was infrequent, they said. The problem is, they said, well, if our theory is consistent, then it's impossible that at this age she has not acquired syntactic regularities. That means it must be performance errors. And then we wash our hands and save ourselves.
That, well, a lot of people think that chord mixing is a performance phenomenon. You know, I don't know if you've discussed this with Sam or with anybody,
yeah.
But this is the huge problem, and this is why if you use variable constraints, in fact, it at least accounts for the data, but it still doesn't tell you what's happening underlyingly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's the most difficult thing to see. Well, continuing, almost finished. On the basis of qualitative and quantitative changes, there seems to be two stages of syntactical development in children, according to all this data. And one would be characterized by the absence of the functional category inflection, which doesn't appear to be syntactically constrained, the utterances, that means this code mixing we talked about. And around the age of 2.5, children stop mixing function words and are rarely violent syntactic constraints on code switching of the type Hopla presented. And this coincides with the emergence of the functional category info, which seems to account for qualitative changes in the child's speech, like the transition from mixing function words to lexical categories, nouns, and the ability to respect grammatical constraints and code switching. In Annika's data, from age 2-6 onwards, most of her mixes seems to concern single nouns inserted and the switch at the switch point determiner noun, like the ones we've seen before. And if we see these tables, we can see the tendency, the utterances in German, what it says, total mix, we can go for the percentages, maybe it's the easiest. Percentages of mix for German utterances and for French utterances, we can see that they tend to disappear towards age 3. Mm-hmm. And we compare Ivar and Annika. Annika is 2-11, so it's practically also 3. And if we check the very last two columns in both tables, we can see the function and lexical percentages,
right,
for the switches. And they're going, the functional, they're disappearing, whereas the lexical are present.
Mm-hmm.
There. So 100% from age 3-5 approximately for one child, and 2-6 for the other. There's a clear separation, and we can see that all switches are lexical and functional word switches are gone. Which this corroborates with the first assumption and other authors' hypothesis too. The conclusion is that changes in formal properties of the mixed speech bilingual children are related to grammatical development.
Mm-hmm.
The conclusion. The appearance of the functional category info again accounts for changes in code switching. The development of pragmatics function, however, that doesn't seem to observe grammatical constraints. They're separate things, after all. Although they're interrelated, but we're talking about different things. Pragmatic aspects of code switching are influenced by external factors like language use in the family, the parents' expectations about language choice, and also their reactions to code switching, which may contribute to the separation of languages and the development of specific strategies to help avoid mixing, like what Annika did as well. Points for further investigation would be to have a look at the causes of early mixing. Are there pragmatic motivations for mixing of function words, or does this kind of mixing indicate fusion of both language systems, this eternal conflict between, are there two separate systems from the beginning or only one? And I think this is still under debate. and also correlations between grammatical developments and formal aspects of language mixing. Are they really universal? And that's why Kirby and Weiser suggest that it would be interesting to analyze the speech of more children acquiring different languages with respect to these questions. And that's where this study I talked about before, Elizabeth Lanza, she does this kind of study with Norwegian and English, and she said that it doesn't hold up this Kirby and Weiser, what they found that it doesn't hold up their, in her informants, their changes, their different results with respect to this analysis. And she found out that her informants mixed function words until the age of 2-7, so it's a lot later than they
were. But they did eventually stop doing it.
Not really.
No?
I haven't read any further.
Because the actual time they do it doesn't matter. It's whether there's an actual stage they come to. That's a very important principle of child learning.
I haven't reached that point.
There are sequences that are important. It's not actual chronological age.
I haven't reached that point yet. I'm still reading it. But I think she says, well, they still, until this age, they mix, and I didn't continue. But here I would like just to finish to talk about my own study, that I intend to do exactly that. Well, analyze the speech of English, Spanish, bilingual speakers, and also have a look at these aspects to see if it's really universal, it's cross-linguistic or not. For me, this was interesting for that. I am going to try to replicate Lance's study and see. Mainly in these two axes, pragmatic and syntactic.
Have you read Andrew Radford's account of language acquisition? Because he talks about inflow, the emergence of inflow. That's the basic.
Yeah, Radford was my very first contact with with Chomsky's theory.
Right.
Through Radford. And that's what we